sauce. There he is. This is the Committee on Health and Human Services. It's February 2nd, and we have four bills to review today. And we're going to begin with Senator Eakin's bill, Senate File 379. Welcome to the committee, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill deals with an issue with sustainability of rural ambulance services. This legislation would provide an opportunity to remove some of the hurdles and streamline the process for an ambulance service in rural Minnesota to use alternative staffing models. Currently, they need to apply to the board for a variance to use an emergency medical responder as a driver. This proposed legislation would allow them to use an emergency medical responder driver with an emergency medical technician in the back of the ambulance. And it would only impact the rural small ambulance services that are in need. There is also an amendment that we would also like to offer, get it in the shape and form.
A quorum is present, so we will distribute. Is it an author's amendment? This is the first hearing.
Right, and this amendment, Madam Chair and members, removes the medical director from the bill to authorize the variance. And
hold on just a moment, Senator. We're sure. Trying to get this distributed.
There it is. Thank you.
All right. Please begin, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This amendment removes the medical director from the bill to authorize the variance. This was not needed since the medical director currently approves and certifies the ambulance roster as qualified. It also deals with rural ambulance services that have a hard time covering its service area that would need to notify the neighboring community that they will be needed. And I do have with me today Mr. Buck McAlpin to testify to the bill and the amendment as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Alpin. Would you please introduce yourself?
Will you represent? Madam Chair, members, thank you. Buck McAlpin of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. This is one of these issues that's kind of enjoyable for the Ambulance Association to work on. We still today, which is a little disappointing, but we know in certain parts of the state, especially during the day, mostly northwest and southwest Minnesota, if you call 911, we can't guarantee the ambulance can respond. And it's like some of our rural fire departments. So we've been in front of you numerous times, numerous years with ideas. Last time we came with this, it was for a variance through the EMS Regulatory Board and a process. These variances have gotten to be a norm for what we do in some of our small communities. This is for communities of 2,400 or less, or outside of our large, big, full-time cities that have resources. It allows a 40-hour trained first responder to drive the ambulance in the front and the EMT, which is a 120, 30-hour trained technician in the back of a basic life support ambulance, to be able to use that staffing. We're one of few states that still require two EMTs in rural areas, and we thought this was a nice opportunity for rural sustainability. To be sure, we wanted the ambulance folks to walk down the street and talk to the fire department and say, let's get you on the roster now, let's be sure you're trained, and we have a shortage and can't cover the ambulance for the day, that we can reach out to a different resource. Secondly, Madam Chair, Senator Eakin talked about another issue. Representative Backer, a new former mayor, EMT from Browns Valley over in the House, brought this idea forward that during the day, and I manage in rural Minnesota and Marshall, there was nothing more frustrating than to hear him page a small rural ambulance four or five times and nobody showed up. And now we're 15 minutes into paging when 8 miles down the road was another ambulance that was available, but they couldn't go into that area until they got requested. What this amendment does is mostly as during the day or up to 12 hours a day, that ambulance service can say, we are not available, we cannot operate, but we are going to be sure the neighboring community can cover our community, and that we'll notify the dispatch center ahead of time. So if a call comes into that small community, they'll send that neighboring ambulance right away and not wait till we're 15, 20 minutes into it. And we know this has been a frustration with the dispatchers in the state when we've talked about it. And this was a really good idea that we vetted through our legislative committee and the Ambulance Association. to have an impact to some of our statewide staffing.
Thank you. Does that complete your testimony?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. McAlpin, Senator Eakin. I'm looking at, on the amendment, page 1, lines 5 through 7, actually the line 7, one registered emergency medical responder driver. That's a 40-hour training course. You mentioned something about training. What was that? And follow-up, would someone trained to operate a fire truck qualify for that? Because I know in a lot of these rural communities, there's volunteer fire departments, and they go through training.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, in Minnesota, to be an emergency medical responder and to be registered with the Emergency Services Regulatory Board, you have to have a medical director and be recognized by a unit. So most all of our fire departments now are trained to that minimum level. They do complete the 40 hours, okay. And the EMT is the higher educated one that's usually on the ambulance as part of their job. And most of our rural fire departments have actually upgraded to EMTs too. So it's just a different resource to reach out to help with staffing.
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, my point was in small towns, they usually already have people. And if there's overlap, that means, well, this says effective the day following final enactment. The fact that it's already in place means it really will be effective day following final enactment. So thank you very much for bringing this.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Just a quick question. It's a little hard here to align the amendment with the bill, and I'm just wondering, for paragraph E, which seems to be where a number of the significant changes are, I'm just wondering if the amendment's been adopted, if staff could read what paragraph E looks like now under the amended language, the amendment.
The amendment has not yet been moved or passed, but do you still?
I would like to hear what the amended paragraph E would look like under the A2 amendment. Do you have that?
Paragraph E. Would you like to answer, Liam? Would you like to speak to this issue?
Yes, Madam Chair. Senator Nelson, the paragraph E would read, for emergency ambulance calls and interfacility transfers, an ambulance service may staff its basic life support ambulances with one EMT who must accompany the patient and one registered emergency medical responder driver. For purposes of this paragraph, ambulance service means either an ambulance service whose primary service area is mainly located outside the metropolitan counties listed in section 473.121, subdivision 4, and outside the cities of Duluth, Mankato, Moorhead, Rochester, and St. Cloud, or an ambulance service based in a community with a population less than 2,500.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson, thank you. Mr. McAlpin or Senator Eakin, I'm having a little trouble translating back and forth here as well. Have we changed anything on the original bill, 379? Lines 2.3 through 2.5. Does that language remain in place with the amendment?
Madam Chair, we had discussed that with our medical directors at the Emergency Care Coalition meeting, and the medical director said that puts us too much into operations. We currently have to certify the roster that you use anyway. That was new language that we were adding, that after we originally drafted this with Representative Backer and Senator Eakin, we decided to remove the medical director piece out of it, because on another piece of statute, they certify the roster as the medical director.
I will repeat that to make sure I understand it, that it was determined that it's not necessary to have a medical director authorize the basic life support because they already
establish a roster that's authorized by the medical director. So the persons that are qualified to do this are defined already. It doesn't require an additional review by a medical director. Is that correct?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Any further questions? Yes, Senator Rosen.
Has the A2 amendment been adopted?
It has not.
Would you like to move the A2 amendment, please?
Senator Rosen moves the A2 amendment. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. And then to Senate File number 379, Senator Rosen moves 379 as amended be passed. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Oh, excuse me. Must be referred to the floor.
Yes, that's what we're going to do. Yeah.
We're going to, we do not see Senator Kiffmeyer here, is that?
She's
yep. Or her testifier is not here yet. So we'll set this aside and pick it up a little later. Okay, Senator Kiffmeyer.
She'll be here in a few minutes. She's in a cab, and my staff person is going to walk her in. Yep. So we'll let Senator Buick single first.
Thank you very much, Senator. Okay, so we will be moving now to Senate File 307. Senator Dietzick, this is a pre-hospital care data collection and reporting responsibility modification. Please introduce yourselves and your testifiers and begin your testimony.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. Senate File 307 transfers the administration of the Minnesota Statewide Ambulance Reporting System from the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board to the Minnesota Department of Health. The Minnesota Statewide Ambulance Reporting System is a statewide web-based system. The system collects and stores data related to ambulance runs. The data is reviewed and analyzed to improve care. The analysis is used to determine what type of education is needed. It helps allocate resources and focus training to best meet the needs of the public. The Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board does not have the resources to properly utilize the data. The Minnesota Department of Health currently collects data on trauma care, stroke care, and cardiac care. Aligning the EMS data with other Minnesota Department of Health data will provide a more seamless system. It will improve outcomes, or we hope it improves outcomes. This proposal has been vetted by the Department of Health, the EMS Regulatory Board, and the Ambulance Association. With me today to discuss the proposal is Buck McAlpine, Government Relations with the Ambulance Association, Minnesota Ambulance Association, if I'm correct, and Mr. J.B. Guyton, Chair of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. I believe Assistant Commissioner Dan Pollock from the Department of Health is also here to answer any questions if you have any. And with that, I would ask that we start with Mr. McAlpine to give you an overview of the proposal.
Thank you very much, Mr. McAlpine. You're here for the day, it looks like.
Yeah, thank you. Madam Chair and Member.
There's not a sign-in sheet there? Is that what you're asking for?
I don't see it, yes.
I guess you don't need one for today.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members, again, Buck McAlpine at the Ambulance Association. This has been something we've talked about for a few years as we've talked to the regulatory board. And again, for those of you, a quick finance lesson. Our EMS regulatory board is always kind of a weird duck of how we put it in statute in 96. It is a general fund supported board and supported off some grant administration. The grant administration is very small. The MSRB is willfully underfunded with FTEs, some things we hope to work on later this session. But one thing that we have talked about is the board has worked, and Mr. Guyton can talk about that, the interim chair, is that what are some programs we remove from there and align better over in health that are more grant administration, and MDH has quite a depth in grant administration. And how do we start to correlate data? I know the American Heart Association supports this. And how do we pull together what we call in the industry now time-sensitive patient care data, trauma, cardiac, stroke, and things that impact survivability? And we've thought and worked hard to make sure that that's a better spot for it. And this legislation basically just picks the program up and moves it from the EMS Regulatory Board to the Minnesota Department of Health.
Thank you. You have another testifier,
sure.
Senator?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the EMS.
Please give us your name and who you represent.
Say that, I'm sorry?
We need your name,
yep.
And who you represent.
Sure.
For the record.
J.B. Guyton. I'm the interim chair of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board.
Thank you. Please continue.
You bet. The EMSRB board did vote on moving this information, both the data and the grant, over to the Department of Health. We're just, as Mr. McAlpin said, we're pretty seriously understaffed right now at the EMSRB and are unable to do our due diligence with this work. And this is a way that to move it to a department that has better ability to take on this work.
Thank you very much. I would just add, I think that you're lifting an existing program. You're not changing any of the essential components of the program, just relocating it with the Department of Health. But just for the committee's information, when you're talking about the responsible for collecting and storing data on ambulance providers in Minnesota, what it is that you're talking about storing? Mr. McAlpin? I'm sorry if I've asked you to speak to something that you're not prepared for.
Actually, I was just looking at that, Madam Chair. It's demographic information, mostly, that we keep. In Minnesota, many of our providers, even our rural ones, if they're not on an electronic EMR, they're on a paper-based form. Most of them are called MnSTAR. That's provided by the board that they take and enter into a program which is able to track the data. But it's demographic location on date, location, cause of illness or injury, information about the condition of the ill and injured person, treatment, comorbidities, medications, and provider impression of the ill or injured is what we collect and report to the board.
And talk a little bit about how the collection of that data helps you improve your responses as an emergency response system.
Hey, Madam Chair, a big piece of what we measure is response time data. It helps us look at how we can better locate ambulances closer to where the volumes are. That's used in large areas and even rural areas. Cardiac survivability, every few years we'll see through the American Heart Association, things change. 1 year we're given epinephrine as the first drug. The next year we find out in our cardiac outcome data that we should be giving bicarb to help with acidosis on people that have prolonged downtimes, and how we use atropine different for third-degree heart blocks and things that impact patients in certain cardiac diseases. And most importantly, the one thing about moving this data to the MDH is our trauma system. We know that we have probably one of the best trauma systems in the country. Everybody has access to air medical here in a timely opportunity, and we have very geographically located trauma centers and a very well-run trauma system. And it's important for the MDH hospital side to correlate that with the pre-hospital side. And really as simple as, did you get there, did you get them loaded up, and did you go to the hospital in 10 minutes? We don't want to sit in the scene and play with you. The only cure for trauma is surgery, so we have to get those folks to facilities. So we measure things like that and how stuff that we're doing when we have first responders carry epinephrine. Last year, Senator Eaton's bill to use Narcan. Are we watching people die of heroin overdoses because we're not administering Narcan? Those are things that are all tracked in this program to really measure survivability and outcomes of patients.
Thank you. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to open a can of worms. I just hope that this has been thought about. What about the community paramedic where they don't actually ever get to the hospital? Are you going to look at that data too? Because this all says pre-hospital, and just want to know where that fits.
Mr. McAlpin?
Madam Chair, we love talking about that program. We have decided, Senator, to keep that out of the MnSTAR, mainly because it's a population health and more of what we're doing internally in our healthcare systems. So we're measuring that data. We did just talk to, what's the big, Stratus Health, the big statewide data, Stratus side, about trying to correlate more of our community paramedic data. But we're keeping that inside our healthcare systems, mainly because we're reporting so much of that to our payers, our integrated healthcare demos and things around the community paramedic outcomes.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You may have said, but I missed it. Is the department in favor of this?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes.
Thank you.
Is there a member, is there someone here from the Department of Health that just wants to confirm that for us? Welcome and introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, Dan Pollack, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Health. Pleased to be with you for the first time in this role. We don't have a formal position on the bill. We've been working with the board and the providers to gather more information. My understanding is there will be some kind of fiscal note based on the new responsibilities going to the health department under the proposal, but I think we're open to providing feedback and taking on this responsibility if it's the determination of the committee to move that work over to us.
So, Assistant Commissioner, I'm going to restate what you're saying, that you're open to the role, but you're neutral in as to whether or not the change occurs.
Yes, Madam Chair. Our priority would be making sure the fiscal costs are appropriated to the department for the collection and the responsibilities.
Of course.
Okay, Madam Chair, I apologize.
Senator Dietzick.
I misstated that, yes. They are not opposed.
Okay, thank you very much. Did I see another question along the way here? Okay, we have another testifier who wants to speak to this bill. Twyla Brace from the Citizens Council for Health Freedom. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm president of the Citizens Council for Health Freedom, a national organization located here in Minnesota, and we are pretty well known for what we do on privacy and the impact of privacy on healthcare choices and on patient trust in the healthcare system. So the issue, we look at Senate File 307 as a government surveillance bill, and as a result of government surveillance, we're also kind of concerned about what that means for patients deciding to come into the healthcare system. So the issue of government surveillance has become a big issue across the country, and concern is growing, not receding. In late 2013, we issued a 50-state report on government health surveillance, and we looked through state statutes to find the many and varied databases created to collect data on citizens, starting at birth with immunizations, birth defects surveillance, and newborn genetic screening databases, as well as cancer. Privacy relates to healthcare choices. We often say, he who holds the data makes the rules. Thus, government officials can use these databases to analyze and profile individuals, using them for research without their consent. They can learn information about individuals that would harm political or other aspirations. And they can use this data for their own purposes, including to drive policies in concert or not in concert with health plans, to restrict access to doctors, penalize doctors for customized care, or limit patient treatment choices. Government has police power. We oppose taking advantage of a vulnerable time in a person's life to expand this police power into the individual lives. We do not believe that the board has the same type of police power as does the Department of Health. If the ambulance groups want to collect this data, they could contract with a private entity to do it and get informed patient consent to send it there. This bill essentially deputizes the ambulance drivers and staff as data collection agents for the government health surveillance, even if the health department has no position on the bill. The entire healthcare enterprise may soon no longer be viewed as a safe place by patients. In their worst hours, they may be trying to protect themselves by saying as little as possible. This is true for some today, but it will become true for more in the future. In 1999, before the Minnesota Electronic Health Records mandate, the California Healthcare Foundation found 15% of Americans choosing to protect their own privacy by falsifying questionnaires, refusing to tell one doctor about another doctor, delaying care, or avoiding it altogether. I'd like to draw your attention to the following language in the bill, starting on page 1, line 21. So the data to be collected includes demographic information on the ill or injured person, information about the date, location, cause of the illness or injury, information about the condition of the ill or injured person, and information about the treatment, comorbidities, medications, and the provider's impression of the ill or injured person. Then lines lines 2.14 to 2.18, where it says that the state will use this data to improve ambulance services quality, develop treatment protocols, or improve outcomes. We don't consider this a job of state government. This is the job of the private healthcare sector, which government often gets in the middle of the way it gets in the middle of through regulatory requirements. So I have a handout for you if there is someone who could get this handout, which will give you, make sure that you have one. Actually, two handouts. So, one of the handouts has a description of the Minnesota Electronic Disease Surveillance System, and the other one has a picture of it. So, if you look at the one that has the most words on, I just gave up my own copy. Just a second here. This one here, which has the description of it. In the yellowed highlighted spot, which talks about that it will be a person-centric system where all information collected is organized around a single person. So all the different databases that the health department has will be centralized upon a single person. Then here from a 2009 report from the health department is a picture of this MEDS, Minnesota Electronic Disease Surveillance System, which...
Hold on. I don't think that's been distributed as of yet, so you might want to slow down just a little bit.
Oh, sorry.
Because we can't see what it is that you're referring to
yet.
Yes,
I understand.
There, I think you can continue now. And would you begin with what you're referring to here, because we did not have this data, Ms. Brace?
Yes. So the other one just talked about an overview of MEDS, the Minnesota Electronic Disease Surveillance System. This one gives you a picture of it. And because I knew that you might not understand what all the acronyms were, we also added what all those systems are. So this would, in essence, add another system. And what is being created here is essentially a profile on individuals, all having to do with health, different parts of their health data and different parts of whether they're ill or not. And in this case, what would be added would be that they took an ambulance, and then whatever the ambulance providers or service thought was information that the state needed to know about them. We instead... We don't think that Minnesotans in crisis should be forced to give up their basic privacy rights. So instead, we're asking the committee, as we're asking the Minnesota State Legislature, to recognize and act on the privacy rights given to Minnesotans in the state constitution, Article 1, Section 10, the rights of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. None of these surveillance systems have any consent, and yet they are being used to create a comprehensive profile, starting at birth with newborn screening, immunizations, and even the birth certificate, which you see in the vital statistics here. So as soon as you're born, you get entered into MEDS, and then as more and more information gets collected on you, it gets added. This is just building this data collection system as opposed to giving people the privacy rights that they have under Minnesota's Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for our testifier at this time? Seeing none, thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Benson.
That's okay. Madam Chair and Senator Dietzick, the information brought forward, the MEDS system, we work really hard at de-identifying data for research purposes. This appears to be doing the opposite. It appears to be taking de-identified data and aggregating it so you can pinpoint an individual. And I know generally judiciary deals with data privacy issues, but our Department of Health seems to be developing a policy of having data based on individuals, not just broad de-identified research. We've been through all the questions on newborn screening, and it was always de-identified. We can't trace it back. When we were talking about collecting data from the hospitals about people in acute care and in a smaller rural setting, you might be able to track data all the way back to an individual in an ICU. So if somebody from the department wants to talk about this, I feel like we're actually unidentifying data, un-de-identifying. That's probably not a word. But it is a concern. So if somebody from the department wants to address that, please.
Welcome to the table. Introduce yourself and who you represent and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, Manny Munson-Ragala, Assistant Commissioner for the Health Systems Bureau of the Department of Health.
Can you speak a little closer into your microphone? Thank
sure,
you.
Sure, I can. Thanks. In response to Senator Benson's question or concern, a couple of observations. First of all, the proposed bill does not change any of the existing data being collected under existing law. It simply transfers the responsibility for managing that data collection to our department. So no new data is being collected. Secondly, based on my understanding of our system, the ability to turn that data into a specific individual profile so that you can identify it was an assistant commissioner who wears bow ties might be remarkably hard to do. Rather, we try to use the data to make some determinations and observations at the system level so that we can provide information to those practitioners to improve their performance on an aggregate basis. I suspect that the phrase that might be creating some consternation is that MEDS is a person-centric system where all information collected is organized around a single person. I think the better way to think about that is we try to have data at a level that allows for consistent information tracking, but that is different than saying allows at a level to individually identify that this particular individual, this person, is Manny Munson-Ragala.
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair and Mr. Munson-Ragala, a person is entered into the system only once. A person, to me, says an individual. Is there some number that's assigned that's in place of an identity? I don't understand how you can enter a person only once and have it not be a person. And secondly, I don't see anywhere on the Department of Health graphic where ambulance information is already being aggregated into the MEDS system. So the data might not be new from the citizen collection perspective, but if it's being put into a Department of Health system, it's new to the Department of Health. So help me with those two things. How is a person not a person, and how is this not new data?
Sure.
Please begin.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the distinction I would suggest is that when you collect data and you have it in two different data sets, the correlation between those data to build those individual linkages is not part of this bill. So the purposes for which the data has been collected for ambulances, as Mr. McAlpin has explained, is at sort of the system improvement level data. The data that you collect for individual, particularly for exposure to communicable disease, needs to be specific to an individual. The purposes being served require a level of granularity that's different. I don't believe we are going to build any components that would require that linkage between the ambulance data to get to the ability to be individually identifiable. And certainly I don't believe the bill contemplates that is what we are to do with it.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Senator Benson.
And, Madam Chair, I just have a concern because we keep putting more and more data into the Department of Health. They keep integrating and integrating and integrating. And so while I would like to take relief off of our ambulance service, I am concerned about where this data is going to end up. I think the taking it taking the data off of the ambulance services is probably the right thing to do. I'm just developing some serious questions about what the Department of Health is going to do with the data.
Assistant Commissioner Munson-Rigala, may I make sure I understood what you said before you go on, that in the instance of infectious diseases, for example, sexually transmitted diseases, you need specificity because you need to contact that person and then make contact with their contacts. But outside of that, you don't collect the data that would individually identify a person. The data is collected in a way that it describes the processes that that person was involved in for improvement to those processes.
Madam Chair,
so the essential question I heard from Senator Benson was that entering the name only one time, so there must be some way that you're reviewing repeated behavior of an individual if that assumption of Senator Benson's is true. Could you run over that again, and then you wanted to continue as well?
Sure. So, Madam Chair, thank you for more clearly articulating the reason why you might want to identify an individual and data you collect. I would make the observation that the bill specifies the use for which this particular data can be used by the department. So no matter what our intent is, the law governs our use of that specific data. So I would direct your attention to Subdivision 4 of the proposed bill, starting on line 2.14. We are to use the pre-hospital care data to, one, improve emergency medical services, clinical system and operational quality, two, develop injury and illness prevention efforts, three, develop treatment protocols, four, improve outcomes of trauma, stroke, acute myocardial infarction, sudden cardiac arrest, and other conditions involving emergency medical services, and five, conduct analysis of utilization and timely access to these services for purposes of Section 62J, 311. As we view those permitted uses of the data, they are at the aggregate population level or system level.
Ms. Brace?
I would just like to respond in saying that it's not clear to me that, one, the name's not going to be collected, two, that the information won't be added to MEDS, and three, just to clarify your question, because I think that, just to be clear, that vital statistics is all identified. Immunization registry is identified. The birth defects is identified because they continue to monitor the child. The cancer is identified because they continue to monitor any patient that has cancer and make them available for research. So I think there's a lot of them identified in here, and in fact, in other documents from the department, it says that they have created a master patient index and that they are on their way, if they're not already there, into connecting with the nationwide health information network, all of which requires a patient identifier.
The question then in front of us is whether or not we want to move the data, the collection, to the Department of Health. It is not a change in the current collection of data, and there are definitions for the use of the data. I see Assistant Commissioner Munson-Rigala has come to the table again. Did you want to say something further at this time? No. Are there any further questions?
I was just going to move the bill.
Okay. Senator Eakin moves... Eaton moves Senate File 307. Did we have an amendment to this bill? Senate File number 307 has been moved, and it would be referred to Judiciary Committee. Any further discussion? Senator Lori, and then Senator Nelson.
We'll just real briefly make sure it goes to Finance then with what the Department of Health had to say at the end of its policy trail.
Okay, great. Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it's been an interesting discussion. I was not aware of MEDS before, but of course I'm wondering if I wanted to know what my MEDS looked like. Could I ask? But I think that's not really the issue here. But I am glad to know that this bill is going to to Judiciary, because I think that's where a lot of the questions that we're talking about right here, which have to do with personally identifying information and how it's used, I trust will be well vetted in that committee. At this point, though, my understanding is it's just changing where the collected information is going, and I can see value in connecting the dots, so to speak, in some cases here. So I'll be supporting the bill, but I will be glad it's going to Judiciary for further discussion.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Senator Benson.
And Madam Chair, I won't be supporting this bill until Judiciary has a good hard look at where this data is going and how the Department of Health is going to treat it. Let's look, for example, page 2, line 19. Other conditions involving emergency medical services, you could literally drive an ambulance through that loophole. If you look at page 1, line 21, et cetera, if you're from a small community, demographic information, 50-year-old Caucasian male, on Wednesday, February 4th, myocardial infarction, you know exactly who that person is if you're in a town of 5,000 people. And so it's easily identified. Until the Department of Health specifically says we're not going to use this as part of the med system to track that individual, I'm going to have concerns about how that information is going to be used. So it's a good idea. We just need more work on the data, and I just want to voice that concern.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Dietzick, you've heard the feedback from the committee. There's been a motion to pass Senate file 307. Any further discussion? It's to be referred to Judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion passes. Thank you, Senator Dietzick. Okay, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Mind hear that.
I thought we were doing it. Welcome, Senator Kiffmeyer. Please introduce yourselves for the record. Your voice will be on the tape then, and your testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Senator Mary Kiffmeyer, and today I'm here in regards to Senate File 233 in regards to adding an option of an accrediting organization for ambulatory centers and others as well. Just to mention, there is no cost to the state. There is no fiscal note. Matter of fact, by adding another option, there are three others. This has the potential to reduce costs by increasing competition amongst accrediting organizations. There is no opposition that I have heard of. And matter of fact, I have a letter in your packet today from the Minnesota organization that is asking for your support, the Ambulatory Surgery Center organization. It is in your packet. And as written, it'd be beneficial to many surgery centers in our state, and their organization supports this change. So I'm glad to bring this bill to you. And it is important that we give care and consideration to accrediting organizations because they're the ones that we depend upon to do that work. And so it is important to consider the choices that we make as accrediting organizations here today. To add a little bit about this organization, the Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare is a private nonprofit formed in 1979, been around a while. They currently accredit almost 6,000 organizations in a wide variety of ambulatory healthcare settings. They are currently in all the states, approximately about 43 states. Actually, Arizona was just added recently. They don't need legislation. Arizona commissioner was able to approve it after due diligence. That letter is also in your packet. They're also the accrediting organization for the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. Coast Guard. So they do accredit over 80 health organizations in Minnesota, but they're not listed in Minnesota statute as a nationally recognized independent organization, a designation that is required in our state to be able to accredit certain types of health organizations, though not necessarily all. My understanding, this omission in statute was not in any way deliberate. It was simply that when the statute was adopted, the AAAHC didn't reach out to the legislature to mention that the organization should be included, and the legislature listed the accrediting organizations that they were familiar with or had heard about. This is not unusual. We've all gone through this where that can happen. So now they have grown to be the largest ambulatory health care accrediting organization in the country and have reached out to the few states that they are not on their listed in their statute. So I haven't done so. I have a testifier here with me today, Ms. Carolyn Kurtz, and I'd like to introduce her and allow her to give you testimony in further regard to this bill, Senate File 233.
Thank you, Ms. Kurtz. Would you say your name in the microphone and your organization again before you begin your testimony?
Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee, and thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. For the record, my name is Carolyn Kurtz, and I am General Counsel and Vice President for the Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare. We are otherwise known as AAAHC. We are located in Skokie, Illinois, and again, my great appreciation to waiting for me to arrive this morning from a very snowy Chicago. We're fortunate to have missed this particular storm. And I am here today to voice our support of Senate File 233. I'd like to provide a little more detail of an explanation about the history of AAAHC and tell you why we believe that this legislation is, in fact, so important. The Accreditation Association, as Senator Kiffmeyer has said, is a private, not-for-profit organization formed in 1979. We just completed our 35th anniversary year. We are the leader in developing standards to advance and promote patient safety, quality care, and value for ambulatory health care through peer-based accreditation processes, education, and research. A certificate of accreditation is awarded from AAAHC to organizations that have undergone on-site surveys by our surveyors and are found to be in compliance with AAAHC standards. Again, we accredit more than 6,000 organizations nationwide, and just to give you an idea of the types of organizations that we do accredit, we accredit ambulatory surgery centers, and you've seen the letter of support for the legislation from the Minnesota Association of Ambulatory Surgery Centers. Community health centers, we have the contract from HRSA to accredit federally qualified health centers. Medical and dental group practices, medical home practices, and managed care organizations, as well as Indian and student health centers, among others. And as mentioned, we are also the official, very proud to be the official accrediting body of the United States Air Force and Coast Guard ambulatory facilities nationwide and internationally as well. With this single focus that we have on ambulatory health care, we offer our accredited organizations a cost-effective, flexible, and collaborative approach to accreditation. And just to give you an idea of the, we accredit almost 90 organizations in the state of Minnesota currently. They are ambulatory surgery centers, dental practices, Indian health centers, medical group practices, student health centers, and I am very pleased to say that this fall I was able to visit Boynton Student Health Service at the University of Minnesota and present them with a plaque which stated that they have in fact been continuously accredited by AAAHC for 35 years. And what a remarkable organization that is. AAAHC, in terms of being a nationally recognized organization, has been nationally recognized by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for two programs, our Ambulatory Surgery Center Accreditation Program, as well as for Medicare Advantage health plans. And we've held this for as long as CMS has granted this. Most recently, in December of 2013, AAAHC was recognized by CMS for the accreditation of the qualified health plans offered in the exchanges. So we're here basically just to ask that Minnesota offer an additional choice to all of the organizations in the state. We understand in the legislation and the statute is currently written that the commissioner always retains oversight, and this just basically gives the organizations another choice for accreditation. And we truly believe that more choice, more competition leads to better quality of care because organizations can choose from accrediting bodies, look at things like cost, look at the standards of the accrediting bodies and see which speaks to them, talk to their peers and see which organization really suits their needs. So we look forward to assisting Minnesota in advancing the quality of care for your citizens and are very pleased to be here today.
Thank you, Ms. Kurtz. Are there any questions for our testifiers at this point? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's any time I hear of a new accreditation, I really start to think about the burden of paperwork and the cost. And if you could address how you're this accreditation, which it looks like you're a HRSA qualified. There's some QMRP stuff in there, so which is good to see. But I still question what's going to be the process for somebody to get accredited by your agency, and how much is it going to cost to have that done, and how much extra paperwork compliance is there in that?
Well, again, similar to the large nationally recognized accrediting bodies really do share very similar processes. So, again, if an organization is going forward for accreditation, as is already in your statute, it's a similar process. We have an application. There's an application fee. And then organizations are assessed a fee for the survey based on their size. So we basically collect demographic information in the application for survey that allows us to assess how many surveyors we will be sending for how many days to the organization.
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a follow-up, it's kind of like that the camel's nose kind of thing. I guess I keep coming back to all these different agencies that have all these different accreditations, and you could put all the acronyms after everything, I don't know anything about your organization or the accreditation, but I'm really concerned if we allow it. I guess the choice is that you can choose to be accredited by you or not. Is really, I'm thinking out loud here, but I just, you talked about there's a filing fee and then there's some paperwork they have to fill out, and how much paperwork is there? Do you know,
Ms. Kurtz?
There is an online application. And that is filled out, and then after that, the organization, we send surveyors on site to the organization. And really what we feel is a very beneficial part of our accreditation process is that our surveyors are, in fact, active in the field for the organizations that they're serving. They bring, and we truly are committed to improving quality of care in provider organizations, improving the quality for members and health plans. And so we really emphasize that we're there to assess compliance with the standards, but we're also there to bring best practices to the organizations. And our surveyors, being well-versed in this, bring the best practices of other organizations that they've seen to the organizations that they survey.
Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so in most accreditations, then there's a cost that is associated with bringing those surveyors out, whether it be the Council on Accreditation is coming to look at CARF. I mean, you're paying anywhere up to $8,000 to $10,000 to bring these surveyors out. How much does it cost to bring these surveyors out to an organization? And the reason I'm asking this question is because I'm getting to, yes, it's great to throw an accreditation out there, but how are we making this either going to be a positive approach or somewhat of a burden when it comes to costing me on my bottom line, especially if I'm, you know, a nonprofit organization that doesn't have that kind of funds laying around? So,
Madam Chair,
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Hoffman and members. Without doubt, any organization has a process, has a cost, but Minnesota statute already requires that they be accredited. So it's already required. It's advantageous to any entity to have choices, to have options of accreditation. They will compare between those accrediting organizations, the time-consuming part of the process, the convenience of the process, the cost. Giving them another option, which is already required by law, can actually have the potential of reducing some of that because they'll have to be competitive exactly on those bases, cost, process, burden of paperwork.
Senator Kiffmeyer, is my assumption true that this is not a situation in which a organization would have multiple accreditations? It is an option among these. They're not under our laws anywhere requiring multiple audits. This would be one of a number of acceptable choices to meet this requirement for review. Is my assumption correct?
Madam Chair and members, yes, you are correct. It is only one accreditation and that the local organizations have the choice of which one.
And then if you look at the language in your bill, it's not new language, it's old language on page 2.1. It says after adding the new AAAHCR, and it says at a minimum defined as nationally recognized independent organizations. So What does that language mean? Does that mean that there are others that are could be by somebody defined as a nationally recognized that would meet the criteria that might be imposed on a hospital or something for accreditation?
Madam Chair, what I see this as in this language, and our general counsel can always add clarification in interpreting statute, but it says they're defined as nationally recognized independent, and that gives centers, CMS. It also uses the Social Security Act or under Section 1876 of the Social Security Act. So it says it right in statute as what that minimum is. And that gives us as legislators an important value here if they're also connected in with those areas, CMS. It helps us to have a greater certainty, but it is a minimum. Each individual organization can exceed minimums. That's always the case, and many of our local organizations often do exceed what we have put in statute, those standards. And that's part of the many times where they will get recognition for going above and beyond. But I think for the legislative requirements, we want to be sure that they are covered at a minimum. But it is one option, one of these, the other ones. There are three other ones. This is just adding one other option. Nothing else is being changed in statute, is either to standards or requirements.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. That helps me. The minimum is referring to a floor of expectations that could be exceeded. But these accrediting bodies are speaking to that floor, to the minimum set of standards. Thank you very much. Are there further questions? Senator Lurie.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Kiffmeyer. So there's three. I had a similar question. Would this additional accreditation body have been allowed prior to this to accredit, I guess, ambulatory surgery centers? Is that what we're trying to do? And do ambulatory surgery centers have a hard time meeting the accreditation standards of these other entities that are geared largely toward hospitals to tell you the truth, JCO, NCQA, mm-hmm. URAC. I mean, is that the issue that we're trying to get at is that ambulatory surgery centers need a different standard?
Ms. Kurtz?
Madam Chair, I'll let Senator Kiffmeyer, Ms. Kurtz, also respond to that. But again, everything that is currently in the statute, nothing has changed. What we're adding here is another option, a competitive option, that would be held to the same standards, the same things that these other three are. They're held to the same thing. So there's nothing changed in that regard. And the difference may be in simplicity, cost, process, or some of those other things. The other thing is, since the AAAHC is one of the largest in the country, I think we're not going to be one in a situation here where we're one of six states who say no when 43 other states have said yes. I think it has an excellent track record. There's documentation as well in your packets. But as far as Minnesota law, Minnesota standards, it is the same as it has been before.
And thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. I'll ask you, Ms. Kurtz, to answer as well. But I just want to highlight what I thought I also heard in Senator Lurie's is AAAHC specifically focused on ambulatory health care and therefore gives an option to that group of providers that may be better for them than the other options?
With that, yes, we are specifically, we were created for ambulatory health care. And so the two really primary programs of AAAHC have been accreditation of ambulatory health care providers, again, ambulatory surgery centers, and then also community health centers, primary care delivery systems as well. And with that, we also have had throughout our 35-year history an accreditation program for health plans, managed care organizations, the current vernacular. So those are the two primary programs, accreditation programs, that AAAHC at this time offers, yes.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I understand, I have no questions about the quality and the fact that competition is, I think, always a good thing. It's great for people to have options. And I think it's equally difficult for Minnesota to be an outlier. like being one of, you know, six out of the 50 states that that would not allow this type of accreditation. But can you help me understand what would the practical effect be of adding this organization, or what would the detriment be if we did not? And so I just kind of need a little bit of effect. What's the practical effect of this? What would we see differently?
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say that in most any case, adding another accrediting organization, so you're part of a nationally recognized organization, is a plus to Minnesota. Not having it is more a sense of why would we keep out somebody from Minnesota, and especially some of these organizations, they are currently using them. You know, some of our organizations are not only active in Minnesota, they're active in other states as well. And so if they're using this accrediting organization in another state, the simplicity of being able to use them also in Minnesota is cost-effective and valuable to them, and gives them that kind of choice to be consistent across those states.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Senator Nelson.
And I think it's an excellent point. As healthcare institutions often have clients from other states. I definitely understand the value of that, and I think we'll probably be discussing that later in this committee and other areas. But is there a case where would this be the case where an organization would choose AAAHC for accreditation as opposed to what they're currently, how they're currently accredited?
Ms. Kurtz?
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Kiffmeyer?
I think in the requirements here, that is definitely a possibility that they may do that. That's the point of, I think, of saying you have another option here and they can consider that. Does it require them? Does it mandate them to even take a look at that? But I would say the practical side of it would be, yes, it would give them an option to consider that.
And, Madam Chair, my final question.
Yes,
then,
Senator Nelson.
On the other end, are there any cases or examples where an organization might achieve this accreditation, but they've not been able to receive accreditation currently?
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, Madam Chair, I think you'd almost have to I don't know of any organizations that would be like that. I don't know how I would even find out as far as how that might be the case.
And Ms. Kurtz, did you want to speak to that, Ms. Kurtz?
Thank you, Tim. That is a very interesting point, and I think that, as Senator said, it's quite correct. I don't know how one would know that. I do know that there are organizations currently in Minnesota that could do that as the way they have the current choice. So that is something that you could have happening currently. And again, every accrediting body has the standards that they go in and objectively review for. So that would be something that is asked in an application, and you would be looking at what was not done to achieve accreditation with one organization. And quite truthfully, really, the surveyors do look for evidence of improvement. So it is a snapshot in time. So if one organization, if they did in fact fail at one point, came back, went through a new review, showed that they'd actually put in the improvements that they needed to become accreditable, this would apply to an organization that had come to us originally, failed, is allowed to come back and show that they have made the necessary improvements to achieve accreditation.
Thank you.
So, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Kiffmeyer, and then I think we need to move.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in response to that, the standards are the standards. They still have to meet them no matter which organization. And so, as we do in anything else, if they don't, they learn and they go back and then they meet them, but they still have to do that. And with three other choices, that can happen amongst them as well. But I think the thing that's most important to us is that our standards are high and that we hold our accrediting agencies to following those standards. And as in reading the statute, it seems to do that in Minnesota law, plus our own Minnesota standards in general, I think, are quite good.
Thank you. Madam Chair, could I move file 233?
Yes. Senator Nelson moves Senate file. I'm sorry, 233, Ambulatory Healthcare Accrediting Organization Edition, and refers it to the floor. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. passes. Thank you
very
much.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Welcome, Senator Hayden, to the committee. You're presenting Senate File 175, which is Regional Emergency Medical Services Program Grants, Procedures, and Administration Modification. Would you please introduce yourself and your testifiers and review the bill for us?
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate File 175, this proposed legislation transfers the authority of the 8 regional emergency medical systems for emergency medical service. Regulatory boards are EMSRB to the Minnesota Department of Health. The 8 regional EMS programs provide assistance and coordinate all the EMS activities in and around Minnesota. They work closely with all the other healthcare disciplines to coordinate the EMS delivery system. The regional program aligns well with the mission of MDH, who oversees stroke, cardiac, and trauma programs. The EMSRB does not have a financial resources or staffing expertise to properly manage the grants at this point, as it's a small agency. The proposal has been vetted by the EMSRB, say that 5 times, board, the Minnesota Ambulance Association, and the Minnesota Department of Health. With me today, I have Buck McAlpine with the Minnesota Ambulance Association.
Thank you. Mr. Alpern.
Madam Chair and members, Buck McAlpin, Minnesota Ambulance Association. Same as the earlier conversation we have, this is one of 2 programs we identified to transfer from the EMS Regulatory Board to the Minnesota Department of Health. A couple reasons. I believe it's only about $5,000 per region was allowed to the board to manage them, and they're at about 10 FTEs now. And with no increase in FTEs, this also aligned well with what's going on over there. The original intent of the regional program language talks about coordination of trauma and cardiac care. There's things many of the regions, 1 metro, 7 of them are in the outstate, coordinate with the Office of Rural Health around putting defibrillators in. Recently, the amendment that passed the House the other night that'll be up tonight in Senator Cohen's committee lists these 8 regional EMS systems is a group that coordinates tracking dollars, where they're spent. They would help distribute Ebola funding. So they're really kind of the eyes and ears for the industry on the ground about what some of the local needs are. Every one of the 8 regions has a competitive bid every 2 years to the state. The MS Regulatory Board worked with us. They didn't have the resources to release the RFP due in January, so we'll still have to work with Senator Lori and his committee in finance about how maybe we extend them past the June 30th deadline to be sure the grants stay in place until, if we're successful, MDH could reissue an RFP for the next 2-year biennium.
Before you go on, the $5,000 per region, where does that money come from?
That comes off the grant administration now, Madam Chair. Each regional grant grantee that's awarded, they take $5,000 off. It is well below what it costs to administer the program.
And the grant money is distributed by the Department of Health is it paid for by the general fund? Is that it's not fees or other source of revenue?
Great question, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, right now they get about $156,000 every 2 years from the general fund, and then they get 90% of all primary seatbelt dollars. And the good thing about the primary seatbelt law is people are wearing primary seatbelts. From the funding standpoint, as that continues to climb, the regional program's revenues has continued to drop in that funding source. So there's a special revenue fund and the general fund that they get money out of, Madam Chair.
So would it be fair to say that this and the other transfer to the Minnesota Department of Health that has a fiscal implication to it is the board's statement that they cannot afford to operate it any longer and want to transfer it to a different person to hold the responsibility financially for doing the work? Would you introduce
sure,
yourself?
Sure, I will. J.B. Guyton, Interim Chair of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. It's the board's feeling that there's not enough staff present at the current time to accomplish this task, and it would mean a major increase in task and the size of the staff. The MSRB was once staffed at about 17 to 19 employees. I think we're down under 10 right now. And
Mr. Gittin, may I ask you this question?
Sure.
By transferring it, does that essential condition remain in place that there won't be enough money that is dedicated to this from these various funding sources to do the job, whether you're doing it
right.
or the Department of Health?
Yes, ma'am.
So there will be a need for additional revenue in order to do the job, whether it's additional revenue to you or additional revenue to the Department of Health?
Madam Chair, there will be a fiscal note that will need to go with this. There will be additional revenue that we'll need to move with this. And within the Department of Health, they have people who have expertise in this area.
And just one more question. Is that the essential issue here? It's not what the program does or what the responsibilities are, but that the capacity to carry out its functions is a struggle because of how much money is dedicated to
right.
this.
Madam Chair, the capacity to carry out functions above and beyond inspection of ambulance services, certification of EMTs, paramedics, and first responders, there's not enough money in the department for them to take care of these other duties.
Thank you. I'm sorry for interrupting your testimony if you wanted to continue.
Just one quick thing, Madam Chair. The other piece about this is the EMS Regulatory Board, about a 19-member board, two ex-officios. Senator Sharon serves on it, and Representative Schoen. Is that there's also been some inherent concerns over a conflict that JB can sit on there, Mr. Guyton, as the board chair, and also benefit from grants through the regional program. And we thought as an industry it was also cleaner working with the MSRB that those grants set in a neutral party like the Department of Health and grant administration.
So that's an additional reason why this might make sense besides the financial issue is some arm's length in the decision making by people that are not necessarily going to profit from the decision. Profit might be a little strong, but benefit. All righty. Does that conclude your testimony, Senator Hayden?
Madam Chair, yes.
So we'll open it for questions. Oh, Senator Eno.
I don't know to whom I should direct this, but on page 1, line 16, we've added and trauma behind the emergency medical or into the emergency medical care. I would anticipate trauma care as medical care. I'm just wondering what the purpose is of placing that in there to highlight it. Is there a purpose, or does it do something?
Mr. McAlpern?
Madam Chair, Senator, you know, exactly. I think we're thinking the same. The reason why we added that is that was one of the time-sensitive syndrome, and in some of the earlier statutes that we wanted to have in this legislation was that it separated medical care and trauma care because they are two different types of aspects of how we look at them to track data and how we look at them, how we care for people.
Thank you, Senator Nina. But the Department of Health, does the Department of Health want to weigh in on this for the committee now?
Madam Chair, Manny Munson-Regala, Assistant Commissioner from the Department of Health. Consistent with our feedback to Senator Dietzick's bill earlier today, the department is neither opposed or supportive of the proposal. We simply just want to be sure that we have the resources to be able to perform the duties contemplated by the bill.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, related to your question a few minutes ago, since this seems to be largely a matter of resources, does either Department of Health or Emergency Medical Services Board think that one or the other is the better place for it, or is it simply that the board doesn't have the funding and therefore we put it in Department of Health, which is concerned they may not have the funding? Is the issue mainly the money, the one you were getting at, or is it that this is a better place for it anyway?
I don't know if Senator Hayden, you would like to speak to that. I would remind you that there were two. The other issue was the grant, that these are grants, and that a member of the board that's right. making that decision can also and be also, a benefactor.
Yes,
so on a policy level, I think that clearly is our discussion. The finance discussion
right.
will be discussed later. Mr. McAlpin?
Madam Chair, exactly what you just said we'd echo. And we vetted this out for, we talked about this for about 3 years, and it was just kind of something we decided it was time to move forward with.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, my question was much along the lines of Senator Marty's, and since I don't sit on that finance committee, my question, I understand the policy rationale. My just very basic question is, do you think it'll cost about the same to implement in the Department of Health, less, more? It'd just be, I don't know if anyone can answer that. It looks like we don't have a fiscal note here today, but I think that's something that I'm sure will be vetted in the next committee.
Yes.
But something that, so I won't even ask you to answer today, but I'll look forward to the answer from that finance committee.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Seeing none, it goes to, well, next. Senator Hayden moves Senate File 175 be passed and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. Is that correct? Is that your understanding, Senator Hayden?
Madam Chair, that's my understanding.
Okay, great. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
That concludes our business today, and the meeting is adjourned.